Well, as the new year approaches, we've been giving thought to new beginnings and how difficult they can be when they contradict long-held personal beliefs. I can't live without sugar is mine. In that spirit, we revisit a conversation with an old friend. Writer Gail Caldwell contracted polio when she was just 6 months old. It shortened one leg by a critical 1.5 inches, so she was like a table that was always a little off balance. She couldn't jump rope or play basketball, but she could swim and row and she could write, earning a Pulitzer for distinguished criticism as a book reviewer for the Boston Globe. Then in her late 40s, early 50s, her slight polio limp became unbearably painful.
The fact of the disease, important but hardly central, had long been incorporated into my shorthand self-description. Writer, grew up in Texas, slight limp from polio. Part of the story I'd told myself all my life was that polio had made me a fighter, that I was hell-bent on being strong because of it, and that much was still true. But in the past few years, within the joys and demands of raising a young dog, I had begun to experience pain and lameness I'd never known before. The mystery of this decline cast a shroud of defeat over what I feared lay ahead. It seemed that the aftereffects of the disease had reemerged, ghostly and conniving, like a stalker who'd never left town.
So that was her story. And then one day, Gail met a doctor who said, "You know, we can fix that." Say what? Gail Caldwell wrote about her subsequent hip replacement and leg lengthening in her memoir, New Life, No Instructions. In April, this frequent guest stopped by our studios, and we saw something the minute she walked in the door. And you know, when I saw you, I can see the difference. I'm starting at the end of the story first. You know, you've changed. Your limp is gone.
Bless you. I hope that's true.
I remember you distinctly standing up from this table, mm-hmm. putting your hand onto the table and the rest of your weight on one leg and swinging another leg around.
Yeah.
Well, how
hoisting myself. I think I did that for years, and I was doing it more and more.
You were using one leg as a cane, almost.
Yeah, and I only knew it when I went back to Texas to see people, and I would see old friends who hadn't seen me in years, and they'd say, "Why are you limping so badly?"
Yeah,
and I'd say, "Because I had polio. You know this about me." And finally, one said, "You never limped like this. You have to go to a neurologist."
Before we get to that, let's remind people where you are in life when this whole chapter of your life takes place. People who've read your earlier memoirs, A Strong West Wind, Tales of Growing Up in Texas, Something of a Rebel. Let's take The Long Way Home, the just exquisite memoir of your friendship with Caroline Knapp, who in turn wrote Drinking a Love Story. Mm-hmm. You and she shared sobriety and a love of dogs, and the men in your life had to deal with it. Then Caroline died of lung cancer. Your mom died. Mm-hmm. Your beloved dog Clementine died. So who is the person we're meeting at the beginning of this new chapter?
Oh, God, I think I was staggering out from all those losses, some of which are obviously predictable. One assumes we will bury our parents. But I decided that the only way that I could see my way through any of this was to get a puppy. And it was only when I was raising her and she was charging down the street like a plow that I began to think that, in fact, maybe she was more of a match for me than I had figured.
Well, but also maybe she was, as they do, pointing you toward another story.
She did. I think she hauled me into the light. I mean, that's the thing. I felt like she was taking me down, and I think you're right. I think the opposite was true, that she hauled me toward a new story.
So the new story is you finally take an X-ray after 15 years of excruciating mm-hmm. pain, and it turns out that the muscle atrophy caused the destruction of your hip bone.
Right. Well, and you know, this is what you said earlier about the story changing. I had been so convinced. When you walk into a room and you say polio, people don't say, "Oh, you have a headache." They just, it's like walking in with cholera. I mean, it's too dramatic to pay much attention to try to footnote the story. And I had seen, oh God, a couple of orthopedic surgeons, it went so across the board, surgeons, physical therapists, and nobody had said, "Well, let's see if there is anything else going on here."
Especially because there is such a thing as post-polio syndrome.
Yes.
So problems in adulthood are the polio coming back with
right.
a vengeance. But?
Well, I finally walked into a new doctor's office, or I should say staggered into one. And the thing that he was so warm and approachable, and yet I realized that he didn't seem that interested in what I was saying.
He didn't want to hear your story.
He really didn't. He wanted to hear it, but it wasn't the be-all, end-all.
Yeah.
First, he said, "What does the MRI show?" And I said, "There was no MRI and no X-ray." And he got very quiet, which is always an interesting sign. He said, "You're on your way to radiology." And within 24 hours, I had a different story.
We're revisiting our conversation with Gail Caldwell about her memoir, New Life, No Instructions, in which she wonders if people who go to Lourdes and receive healing miracles hold on to their crutches just in case, the way people hold on to stories about themselves. Gail's stories included losing her mom, her best friend, author Carolyn Knapp, and her beloved dog within a few years. And for 15 years, there was the childhood limp from polio that got worse. Then she got a new puppy. Walking him was excruciating. Her doctor ordered an X-ray, and suddenly Gail had a new story to live. But as she told us in April, Gail Caldwell also had a new story to write. Before a recommended hip replacement, she'd begun a completely different book.
I had thought that I was writing a book about attachment and this kind of preposterous, if you will, yes, but feeling of middle age when you think want is bumping into entropy and you just keep going. And my mother, who had died in 06, had kept surfacing in a ghostly kind of way. And I wrote my editor and said, "My mother and my history with polio are really showing themselves in this book." And that was before I had any understanding that the story was about to change.
Yeah, because your mother was the one who, when you were a little girl, your mom would lay with you and do these exercises with you, just an incredibly strong bonding moment that you had to go for how many years?
My mom was my first rehab coach.
Right.
I remember it as this infinite dragging phenomenon of being on the floor with her doing exercises. But I thought, as an adult, surely it wasn't that long. Mm-hmm. And when I asked her, she said, "Oh, it was a couple hours a day for 3 or 4 years," which, of course, is forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she never gave up. And I still remember her voice. I still remember her lying next to me doing every one of the exercises. We'd do leg lifts and ankle raises, and I remember her saying, "Just a few more, honey, I'll do them with you."
Yeah.
Obviously, I can still quote it with the inflection is the same. I think I have that voice so inside me.
Your dad, too, got you the cowboy boots with the heels?
Oh, God, yeah, what a pair they were.
Yeah.
Refused to give up. My dad was like, "There's nothing you can't do."
Yeah.
And I would go home when I was, 45, and he'd see me limping across the den, slight limp. He'd say, "You mean that leg is still bothering you?" And it just infuriated me. I'd think, does he really think that polio is something you, like, outgrow? But he just refused to believe that it was tougher than I was.
Well, come to find out, you don't outgrow it, but you finally take an X-ray. And what did the doctor tell you that it showed?
He called me as I was leaving my house the next day and said, "Well, no wonder you're in so much pain. You have no hip left."
Yeah.
And he said, "Do you have any questions?" And I said, "Well, I have a lot of them, but the first thing I really want to know is what you think about this." And he said, "Well, to tell you the truth, I'm relieved. We can do something about this."
Hmm.
Which nobody had said to me, I think, ever about polio.
Not only replace the hip, but lengthen your leg.
Well, and that turned out to be a different piece of it. My surgeon, when I met him, said, "We can lengthen the leg while we're in there," as though it were, you know, "We can cross the street. We can get a cup of coffee." And I was like, oh, my God, lengthened the leg. It was such an extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
So, in fact, they were able to make up for about half of what they call LLD, leg length discrepancy.
Yeah, 5/8 of an inch.
Yeah.
Never has 5/8 of an inch
felt
bigger.
Yeah, exactly. I'll never think a fraction is a small number again.
Well, but before the surgery. Now, this is very dramatic. It's surgery, and it's potentially life-changing. But tell what's going through your mind at this point?
What was interesting to me was that I went into this with a whole lot of hope and a whole lot of doubt colliding, which is maybe one of the things that happens to us in life about being human. And it was very frightening to me. And I also did not know, I think I'm glad I didn't know, how much work was going to be entailed.
Yeah.
When I got on the other side of this, because I felt like, you know, I said that I felt like the Tin Man for a long time. I kept feeling like somebody had handed me this new machine and said, "You have to learn how to use this."
Yeah.
I mean, my leg, I had to teach it how to walk because I had polio when I was 6 months old. So I never walked with two legs that were equal. So now I had this new longer leg, and I kept having images of a foal when they stand up for the first time. And there are these floppy limbs, and they don't know what to do with them. I really felt that way.
Yeah.
There was this leg that was longer and sort of in the way because I had to train the muscles.
Yeah, the muscles that had been atrophied, but also all the other muscles, they said, well, there's nothing for us to do here, so they'd gone to sleep.
Exactly.
Yeah, wake
everybody was like, get a job, you know?
It's quite something. And before all of that, before the surgery, there's a moment where you no one will relate to this. You have one of those late nights where you suddenly, well, maybe I'll just, you know, my life is maybe about to change. Maybe I'll assess my life so far. And it's always dangerous to go near Google.
Oh, God, yes.
You're Googling old boyfriends. Oh, look, they live in, you know, beautiful homes in Greenwich, Connecticut and give flawless dinner parties. And you're sitting there eating takeout with your dog.
Right.
And you fall into a little bit of the pity pop. I'd forgotten to marry and have kids. I often preferred canine companies to humans. I would die sad and alone. Such was my recitation of despair, pulled out from time to time like an ill-shaped sweater. You can't bring yourself to give away. But the next day you're rowing and that script starts to fade.
Right.
This whole idea that we have to let go of the stories we tell of ourselves.
Absolutely. And God knows. I mean, I think this may be a human condition. The stories we tell ourselves are so powerful. And you have to really be careful because if there's not anyone else listening and it becomes that recitation of despair, I think it's an endless loop. And I think the beauty and magic of story when we share them, whether we're writing them or we're having lunch with a friend and being intimate with them, the audience who loves you or who listens helps to shape it.
Yeah.
And otherwise, the narrative is a locked room.
So here you are, post-surgery. I'm wondering if a part of your fear going into the surgery might also have been the person that you might be leaving behind with the deficit in the leg,
mm-hmm.
was the person who knew Caroline, mm-hmm. who knew your mother, mm-hmm. who knew Clementine.
I think it's always, I just realized I'm nodding and I should make that verbal.
It's radio.
I think there's a way, and you know, maybe this happens at midlife. There's a way when you start to accumulate the losses and you feel a loyalty to them because mm-hmm. they're part of your story. So you don't want the story to change so much that it becomes unfamiliar. But when we're talking about what do you do when the story changes? One reason that I had to sort of embrace the right turn that this book took was that I felt that I was being given another chance to think about the way we tell the story of who we are, and that the way you tell the story is what shapes the life in a way. One begets the other. You think the events become the story, but sometimes the story becomes the truth.
Mm.
And I think it's really important in anything to be able to open your heart enough to change that, whether it's about leaving a bad relationship or calling a doctor at the right time or saying, oh my God, I need help here.
Yeah.
I can't be married to the facts that I thought were right.
That's Gail Caldwell, her new book, New Life, No Instructions. Gail, thank you so much.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Robin.
And we spoke with her last April. You're listening to Here and Now.